It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hospitals began distributing COVID-19 vaccines to healthcare workers last week, a sign the tide might be turning on the pandemic. Now, healthcare systems have had to make sure it arrives and is administered safely and stored safely. Dr. Graham Snyder is the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at UPMC, and he's the head of its COVID-19 task force. Dr. Snyder, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me on the program today.
So, doctor, how many doses of the vaccine do you have? What are the plans for getting additional shipments? What can you tell us?
Well, we have started to receive and anticipate in this current allocation getting tens of thousands of doses, and they are arriving daily at our hospitals. The number of vaccines that we're going to get is a changing number, but we have been in steady communication with our public health colleagues at the state. They are constantly assessing with us how many people have we vaccinated, how many people do we still have in our hospitals and clinics to vaccinate. And we're very excited that we'll be able to get pretty far into vaccinating the healthcare worker force within the next few weeks to a couple months.
So I'm sure the planning had been going on for quite some time in anticipation that the vaccine would be approved and start being delivered your way. So how did you prioritize which UPMC healthcare providers get the vaccine, and what was that process?
We leaned on the planning that we do every single year for the flu vaccine. We took that machinery and adapted it to the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, there's a couple of unique things about COVID-19 vaccine that are different from flu. One, this is a really compressed time frame. It's a miracle of science that we have a vaccine within a year, but everybody is working hard to take, now that we know it's safe and effective, to get it into people's shoulders so that they can be immune. It's a limited resource to begin with. So we had to figure out how to allocate this limited resource. From a public health standpoint, they got us started by giving us the phase 1A, phase 1B, and phase 1C. Phase 1A is healthcare workers and residents of skilled nursing facilities. So that's where we're starting. Within that group, though, at UPMC, we have more healthcare workers than the initial amount of vaccine that they're giving us. So we convened a group as soon as we knew vaccine was coming to talk about what are our priorities for this vaccine. And with some guidance from public health, and a group of experts within our own team, including people with experts in viruses, vaccines, clinical trials, ethics, and more, we built a prioritization scheme so that we can give it where the vaccine will have the most impact first.
Mm-hmm. We know, we've heard, this vaccine has to be stored at very cold temperatures. For UPMC, what did that mean? Did you have any difficulty obtaining the freezers that were needed?
It is unique for the Pfizer vaccine that requires ultra cold storage. So we just had to marshal our resources to make sure that we had positioned appropriately the ultra cold storage. And in some cases, it already existed. In some cases, we got more. In some cases, we are using the ultra cold storage of our friends in the research community.
In November, you said UPMC had basically had a practice run with Operation One Shot. That was for influenza vaccine. Why was a practice run when you had enough vaccine doses for maybe 70% of your staff, but have definitely less for COVID vaccine at this time?
So pre-COVID, they had set up Operation One Shot as a way to test out their plans to distribute a medical countermeasure to our large community. Now, with COVID, we followed through with that plan, scaled it back slightly because we had a lot of work to do related to COVID, but still were able to demonstrate that we could get a vaccine and distribute it very quickly to our community. We've taken those learnings and adapted it to COVID. Once you thaw this vaccine, you got to use it within a limited time period. So what we learned is exactly what we're applying here for the COVID-19 vaccine.
Mm-hmm. What part of the logistics has been most challenging to work out?
Prioritization has taken a lot of work. It took a lot of deliberation from our clinical advisors to figure out a way to prioritize our healthcare workers in a way that is fair, that is equitable, and that is effective. And lots of conversations. I'm sure the healthcare systems around the country are going to take a slightly different approach to this. But we put a lot of deliberation in it. And then translating that prioritization into actually getting people scheduled for the vaccine and making sure that they're in the right priority group, that takes a lot of work.
UPMC is not requiring all of its care providers to get the vaccine. Why not?
We're not. I look to our influenza vaccine experience, and for our organization for a few years now, the influenza vaccine has been mandatory, and that's a similar experience to many healthcare organizations around the country. Why did the flu vaccine become mandatory at so many hospitals? It's because we had decades of experience with both the virus and the vaccines. It's because we had a lot of research trying to understand how do you improve healthcare worker uptake of vaccines. And then after we have research that says, if you do everything you can, you can only get vaccine acceptance up this high. We then also have research that says, if you make it mandatory, here is the impact on the people, including the patients in your hospitals. Put differently, we know a lot about the vaccine, have a track record of safety and efficacy over time. And we also have research that says, if you make it mandatory, it has a positive impact on your organization, including the patients you're caring for. So compare that to COVID-19 vaccine. We have good data that it's safe and it's effective. We're going to continue to learn more about that. But we don't yet have data on the impact of making it mandatory, or we don't have data to know what the acceptance rate is. Now, we may find for the COVID-19 vaccine, if acceptance rates are already high, 60, 70, 80% or better, and in our organization, that's actually what I'm expecting in most of our hospitals, that may be enough for it to be highly effective at keeping people safer in our hospitals without needing to make it mandatory. So those are the reasons why we are not yet making it mandatory. It is, for the foreseeable future, voluntary.
Finally, have you gotten the COVID-19 vaccine? And if not, will you?
I will be getting it when it's my turn in line. So I'll get the vaccine when I'm invited through our prioritization groups. I'm going to be excited to get the vaccine. I'm convinced it's safe and effective. I'm convinced it plays a role for me, both in my personal life, but also as a healthcare worker. When I see patients in the hospital, I think it's going to play an important role in keeping me and those around me safe.
Dr. Graham Snyder is the Director of Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at UPMC, and he's the head of their COVID-19 task force. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on the program.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A union local has accused a landmark Pittsburgh hotel of misusing funds meant to keep workers on the payroll during the pandemic. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports.
The Omni William Penn shut down in March after the pandemic struck, devastating the hospitality industry. The elegant 100-year-old downtown hotel laid off more than 300 workers. One was Zebedee Williams, an overnight banquet houseman who made about $17 an hour setting up and tearing down weddings, parties, and other events. Williams has three daughters, the youngest born in February, and a partner on disability. At first, he got by on unemployment benefits. Then things got tight.
The money starts riding up to where maintaining everything, paying bills, paying rent, food, things like that, to where it was becoming a little harder around July, August.
For the first time in his life, Williams sought help at the food bank, but that wasn't enough either. Some days, Williams skipped meals.
It's not right for the kids not to eat, and I would do it 10 times again if the situation happened. I would make sure my children eat, and I would make do.
In a time of widespread unemployment, Williams' story is all too familiar, but there's a twist. The Omni, where Williams had worked for 3 years, received federal pandemic relief loans meant to keep workers like him on the payroll. The Paycheck Protection Program offered the forgivable loans to cover payrolls for up to 8 weeks. PPP loans can be forgiven if 60% of the money is used for payroll. The Omni asked the government for $3.5 million and said it would retain 365 workers, according to government documents. On April 5th, that application was approved. But Williams says he was never paid by the hotel. Same for Will Arthur, a waiter there.
To my knowledge, our workers haven't seen a dime.
Arthur and Williams belong to the labor union Unite Here, with 300,000 members in North America. Omni is a national chain. Using government data, Unite Here calculated 32 Omni hotels received a total of $76 million in PPP loans. The union says the William Penn in Pittsburgh is one of several where little or none of that money was paid to union members. At the Omni William Penn, Unite Here represents some 260 workers, about 70% of the hotel's workforce. Nia Winston is manager of Unite Here's Midwest Joint Board, which oversees Pittsburgh Local 57.
It's completely unacceptable.
So that $3.5 million Pittsburgh's Omni William Penn received, where did it go? In a written statement, the chain acknowledged that Omni William Penn got PPP funds and that it didn't use them to pay laid-off workers. A business can use PPP funds for payroll even if it stayed closed during the pandemic, but Omni didn't want to do that. Instead, it used the money mostly for non-payroll purposes and said it will repay any loan funds that are not forgiven. Tim Stretton is a policy analyst with Project on Government Oversight. The nonpartisan watchdog tracks PPP funds. Companies can use less than 60% of a loan for payroll as long as they do pay back the government. But Stretton said that's still inappropriate. The loans carry an interest rate of just 1%, and the funds were intended mostly to help workers directly, not companies. If unions see something wrong, he says,
they should report this, because without that, law enforcement or even the agencies themselves and the inspectors general, they won't know where to start looking, because again, there are millions of loans.
But Unite Here has another grievance. In July, an Omni attorney wrote Unite Here's Pittsburgh Local seeking wage rollbacks and benefit cuts, which he said would, quote, facilitate the reopening of the hotel. However, union official Nia Winston said the biggest problem is that the hotel hasn't even told workers whether they'll be rehired once it reopens.
We need the employee to meet us halfway, and they're not doing that here.
Zebedee Williams, the laid-off banquet man, says he just wants to make a living again.
One, I would like to go back to work. It would be nice if the Omni extended their hand to the families that they say they are part, that we're a part of, and try to help us.
Omni says it has provided financial assistance to workers in cities including Pittsburgh. But Unite Here officials said they confirmed only one union member in Pittsburgh had received such aid. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Just after sunset, look up in the evening sky and you'll see a once-in-a-lifetime astronomical event, the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. In other words, you'll see a double planet. With us to explain this event is Mike Hennessy. He is the Buell Planetarium Manager at the Carnegie Science Center. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, Mike, how once in a lifetime is this planetary event?
This is once in a lifetime. The next time that Jupiter and Saturn will be this close from our perspective on Earth at a time that's good to see them will be in the year 2080. Now, we get a great conjunction about once every 20 years, but this is the closest they've appeared since the time of Galileo in 1623.
Wow. I mean, so it's the closest in about 800 years?
Exactly. And even that one, if Galileo were able to see it, it wouldn't have been as visible. That one would have been lost in the glare of the setting sun. So we're getting a better front row seat at it than Galileo did.
I'm sure he was disappointed by that.
Right.
From our perspective, how close will Jupiter and Saturn appear to be to one another?
So from our perspective, if you were to hold out your arm in the sky and put your index finger out at arm's length, look at the distance of your index finger. That's about 1 degree in the sky, give or take. They will only be a fifth of a degree apart.
Okay, now, in reality, how far away will these planets be from each other?
In reality, they'll still be over 400 million miles apart from each other. Saturn's twice as far away from the sun as Jupiter. And I like to think of them as two runners on a track. So Jupiter is a little closer to the sun, and it's taking a faster lap around the sun every 12 years. Saturn's moving slower on an outer track. It goes around the sun every 29 years. And so what's happening from our perspective on Earth, think of us as just another runner on the track. We're looking over, and we're seeing every 20 years these two runners, Jupiter and Saturn, they appear to be close as they're lapping around the sun.
Well, that doesn't seem fair that they have different laps to run.
Yeah, Saturn has a lot more work to do. That's why it's huffing and puffing a lot slower out there in the outer solar system.
Okay, so people should be able to see it with their naked eye, correct?
Yes, you don't need any special equipment. Just head outside shortly after dinner. They will set in the west at 7 p.m., so get outside right after dinner and look southwest. If you do have a backyard telescope, though, the view will be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Is there something specific that people should look for, whether it's with the telescope or with the naked eye?
With the naked eye, look southwest for that bright double planet. With a telescope, I would look for the bands of Jupiter, so those stormy stripes moving around that gas giant. You might see four pinpricks of light, and those are the four largest moons of Jupiter that Galileo himself discovered back in the early 1600s. And check out Saturn's rings through binoculars or a small telescope as well. This is a great year for looking at Saturn's rings. The north face of those rings are tilted toward Earth, and it's pretty spectacular. I've been following those over the past few months.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned when's the next time that this super conjunction would happen, but do I understand they actually align about once every two decades?
They do. Yeah, they line up about once every 20 years. This is the closest that they've come in 400 years, but it will happen again 20 years from now. The next time they'll be this close, though, and during a time of day and a distance from the sun that it will be good viewing will be in March of 2080.
While we have you, Mike, what are some other maybe cosmic events around Christmas, this time of year, during the winter, that you think people should look out for?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot of amazing stuff that we can be looking at this winter. And another one that you can see with the naked eye are the Geminid meteor showers. And those you can head outside throughout the month and check out. And you don't need any special equipment. You just need to give your eyes a little time to adapt. And you can take those in and enjoy them.
Sounds like you're excited by all this.
I am, and I think that the Great Conjunction is just a perfect opportunity to get people excited to go outside and look up and remind them there's always something exciting happening in our night sky, something to go outside and enjoy and connect with nature.
Mike Hennessy is the Buell Planetarium Manager at the Carnegie Science Center. Thanks so much, Mike.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.